The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly World Cup Preview. Three podcasts, the first two taking you through the groups one by one with simple questions like who is the manager, ones to watch, dark horses, and the third pod, a Group G special, England's group, which will be a bit more like a usual one as we plot the Three Lions' path to certain victory in Russia this summer. All of it neatly put together so you can impress your friends if you have any. So here's the World Cup Preview, groups A, B, C and D, brought to you by the Guardian Football Weekly. All right, there is no panel in front of me. I am alone, different to the usual pods. We wanted to speak to journalists and broadcasters from all the countries involved. Well, almost all of them. Once the World Cup is underway, me, Barry and whoever we can find will be doing one pod every game day, by the end of which we'll hate each other and you will hate us. But don't worry about that right now. Let's get started with Group A. Seems like a sensible place to start. The tournament kicks off with a match between the two lowest ranked teams in the competition, Russia and Saudi Arabia. In fact, by average ranking, Group A is statistically the weakest group of the lot, raising a lot of eyebrows at Russia's good fortune. Elliot Rothwell, a football journalist based in Moscow, tells us more.
When it was first drawn, I think it was viewed with a lot of positivity. This was really before Salah had his breakout season with Liverpool, where he's just been scoring every single week. Before the injuries happened, obviously they knew that Uruguay was going to be a really tough game. I think Cavani and Suarez are up there with probably the best strike forces in the competition. But people really expected Saudi Arabia to be an easy game. They expected Egypt to be a manageable game. But the former friendlies have been atrocious. They've not had any competitive games to get themselves ready, obviously, because they're the hosts. And really, they're really struggling. A lot of people think now that they might not even make it from the group. The Saudi Arabia game really does present a huge opportunity for a massive banana skin.
Following Euro 2016 and the violence in Marseille between supporters of Russia and England, one of the narratives has been the fear of hooliganism casting a dark shadow over the tournament and fan safety.
I can't really see much trouble happening, but obviously it's something that you can't predict, and I don't want to say that there's going to be nothing happening, because it only takes a few people to cause chaos, really. So I think that it's unlikely, and I think that Russia has done everything that they can to make sure that it doesn't happen, because in terms of their image as a country, in terms of the PR value of the tournament, if violence does happen like it happened in Marseille and in France, then really the tournament will be overshadowed by that, and all of the headlines in the press everywhere will just be about more Russian violence and them failing to control the hooligan element in the country. There's been recent news stories, and I've been told from a few sources, about the plan to deal with possible trouble during the World Cup. And I got told from a journalist that I know, a Russian journalist, that most of the people who came back on a certain flight from Marseille after the events in 2016 have been banned from the tournament. They've been told to stay away from games. They've effectively told that if they're seen anywhere near a game or anywhere near a stadium during the tournament, they'll be kind of put under house arrest, at least made to stay at home during the games. And I think the police presence will be huge. I mean, we saw a glimpse of it when Arsenal came to Moscow to play against CSKA in the Europa League, and I think that will be magnified.
The other two teams in the group, Egypt and Uruguay, both host some incredible attacking talent. Uruguay's Edison Cavani was the top scorer in qualifying in South America. He'll be partnered by Luis Suarez. Between them, they scored 53 league goals for their clubs this season. Could prove one of the most potent attacking forces in the tournament. I spoke to Tim Vickery. He knows everything about South American football.
Well, you know, a year ago, Uruguay were looking in total despair. The wheels had come off their World Cup qualification campaign. They were leaking goals all over the place. And at that point, you really wondered if they were going to qualify. Fast forward a year, and there's been a real change of tone. A lot of people in Uruguay think that semi-finals is well within their reach. And, you know, even the captain, Diego Godin, is saying, well, it's not a utopia to dream even about winning the thing. So what's happened? Well, they've renewed their side. They've got a solid core. They've got seven members of their squad from the South Africa semi-final campaign in 2010, which includes that rugged defensive unit there, Muslera still the goalkeeper, Diego Godin, one of the world's great combative centre-backs, and that great strike partnership of Luis Suarez and Edison Cavani. They'll hope that this time Suarez won't invent some bizarre way to rule himself out of the competition. But what they've done, which has really changed the mood, is that they've renewed their midfield. Now, this has a great deal to do with the project that the coach, Oscar Washington Tabárez, put in place when he took over his second spell in charge of Uruguay 12 years ago. 12 years, that's a long, long spell. No one has taken charge of as many games with one national side as Tabárez has with Uruguay. What he did, perhaps even more importantly, I think, than taking them to the semi-finals in 2010, than winning the Copa America in 2011, what he did was he thought, well, Uruguayan domestic football, with a market just over 3 million, it ain't going to cut it in the globalized era. So what we have to do is we have to use our youth sides to identify players who are good enough to play globalized football, to develop them, to give them a crash course in the history and the identity of the importance of the sky blue shirt, and build a link, build an emotional bond between them and the sky blue shirt, and then we funnel them through to the senior side. It's something very similar, in fact, to what Gareth Southgate has just started to do with England, where Uruguay have been doing it for a while. They went bold. As I said, a year ago, they were looking in despair. So it was a time to go bold. And suddenly, Tabárez promoted a number of recent graduates from the under-20 side, and they now have a midfield that is capable of protecting the defence, of retaining control possession, and of supplying the strikers. The key man, I think, in that midfield is the lanky Juventus player, Rodrigo Bentancur, who is mature well beyond his years. He seems very, very clever at dictating the rhythm of the game from centre field. So suddenly in Uruguay, everything is optimism, added, I think, by the fact that the draw has been relatively kind to them.
For Egypt, the excitement of a first World Cup for 28 years has been dampened slightly by the fitness concerns over Mo Salah. Here's Ahmed Youssef of Egyptian football website Kingfoot on how the fans at home felt watching the Champions League final.
When it happened, it was quite a shock for everyone in Egypt, because a lot of people following Liverpool because they want to see him play well and do special things. And it was the first occasion that we could really see him in front of the whole world, and we were all kind of wanting to do something special. So there's a lot of anger at Ramos as well, and it's turned a bit of sadness now. He'll be out for about 3 weeks, so he will feature. He will go to the World Cup in the last game, definitely, but it's how much game time he can have in the first two games. It's quite worrying.
Salah is the most well-known name in the squad, but if we're to assume that he might take a game or two to get going, who else do Egypt have to do the business?
So one of the key players which I think is going to do very well is Trezeguet. So Trezeguet is playing in the Turkish league for Kasımpaşa. He scored 13 goals this season, and he's one of the only players in the attacking side in Egypt who will drive into the box. He gets the ball, he's happy to dribble and go past players. And he was the one who won the famous penalty which Salah scored, just by getting up, getting into the box. Which other than the Nentu, there's a lack of threat up front and a lack of goals. Egypt they play quite defensively, so and that mainly is suited them because of the lack of attacking threat, really.
In Group B, Spain are the top seed. Their squad contains more players from Real Madrid than Barcelona for the first time at a tournament since 2006. Here's Sid Lowe.
I don't think Madrid's players outnumbering Barcelona players necessarily changes the way that Spain will play at the championships. I think it changes a little bit some of the kind of, if you like, the packaging around it and some of the way that people will respond to the national team. But I think in terms of the identity and the way they approach the tournament, I don't think it makes a huge difference. When Spain won the Euros in 2008 and the World Cup in 2010, I suppose when they won the Euros as well in 2012, but by then the identity had been entrenched. One of the things they got wasn't just success, but a very clear sense that this is the way we have to play. This has to be, if you like, kind of a roadmap to follow in the future. So they developed an identity that they felt suited the way they play, suited the kind of players they have, and importantly as well, differentiated them from other countries and changed the nature of the way that other countries see Spain and the difficulties that Spain pose for them. So I think that identity has largely been maintained. You look at some of the Real Madrid players who are in the squad. I mean, obviously, you know, when you talk about Sergio Ramos and Nacho and Dani Carvajal, defensive players, perhaps this has less of an impact. But the kind of creative players who come in who weren't at previous tournaments, you've got people like Asensio and Isco in particular. These are players who, in terms of the identity, largely fit that idea of you keep the ball, you keep possession. It's technically very, very strong. You try and create chances, but fundamentally you keep the ball circulating all the time. And I think that kind of sense of a technical approach based on touch and talent is reinforced by those players. So I don't think it necessarily changes anything. I mean, obviously, you know, one of the things that's been talked about is who's going to be Iniesta when Iniesta goes. And one of the answers to that question is, well, Isco might be the closest thing. Now, they're not really the same player, but in terms of expressing that kind of identity, I think there's something in that. So I don't think it significantly changes the way that Spain play.
What about the European champions, Portugal? They may have taken the continent by surprise in winning in France 2 years ago, but journalist Nuno Travassos argues they won't be underestimated by anyone this time round.
Yeah, I think after the European title, Portugal will not surprise anyone no more. Now everybody will be very careful about Portugal's team, about Portugal's way of play. So that surprise element is out of plan now. Portugal always had talent, but in big tournaments always had difficult to show this. And now I think the European title showed to the players and even to the fans that Portugal can make big tournaments, can win titles like this. That was very important, that title.
Moving on to Morocco, they are 42nd in the world rankings, have the most foreign-born players in their squad. It's their first World Cup since France 98. Here's Amine El Amri, writer for Le Matin in Morocco.
It's a dream coming true. It's been 20 years and people were expecting this qualification. We missed it by a near point in 2006. And we were all over the place in 2010 and 2014. So now it's a huge, huge experiment, and everybody hopes the team will get well there.
Your manager is Hervé Renard, who I remember being terrible for Cambridge United in 2004. But he's he's much better as an international manager in Africa than he is in League Two in England. How's he viewed over there?
Indeed, he did. Very poor too at Sochaux in France, where the team went down to League Two for French second tier. But in Africa, it's been a dream. He won two titles in the AFCON, in the Africa Cup of Nations, with two different selections, which never happened before. And now he's doing very well with Morocco. Morocco qualified for the World Cup, not conceding a single goal in the group phases for the qualifiers.
So what type of football do Morocco play? Are they very defensive then? Do they just park the bus?
Yeah, well, actually, it's a very solidarity game between the players, and there's a fighting spirit. I think this is what lacked in the previous teams and the previous coaches. I think Renard is gathering a group of men, and he's teaching them this fighting spirit that he is, and yes, this is solidarity is the main character of this team.
Football in Iran is a big deal. Pasha Hajian from the Golbazan podcast is here to get us excited.
If you go to the streets of Tehran, you don't speak the language, or that other person doesn't speak English, you just say football, you're already talking business. And it's our biggest biggest sport in Iran. It's pretty much our religion. And the second I would say is wrestling, but definitely football has always been a huge part of everybody's life in Iran. The country will stop, but if we win, it's going to be mental. Unfortunately, we didn't get the luckiest group, but we're looking forward to it. And it's definitely one of the most interesting groups because you have the best team in Africa. You got the best team in Asia. You got the Spain. Obviously, Spain has always been one of the most dominating teams in Europe. And then you have the European champions. So everybody's looking forward to it.
I think a lot of fans over here will have virtually no idea about the Iranian football team. What style of football do you play?
Well, we play a very compact counter-attacking style of game, pretty much like a little Portuguese style of play, as I like to call it. High compact defensive line, and then we counter. Pretty much just a typical, if people have watched Jose Mourinho throughout his tenure, that's a style of play that Carlos Queiroz usually profoundly plays. And obviously with the likes of Spain and Portugal, we have to play like that. To remind folks, if you look back 4 years ago, the way you played against Argentina, which a lot of people were surprised at with the result of that match and the way we performed, we're pretty much just going to play very compact and then counter those teams.
So that was Groups A and B. We'll be back with Groups C and D in just a minute. Well, Welcome back to this Guardian Football Weekly World Cup preview, Groups A through D. We're on to Group C, which is France, Denmark, Australia and Peru. And if you were hoping for a French meltdown, Philippe Auclair has some bad news for you.
Well, I think it's a group that lives pretty well together. Perhaps that was actually one of the reasons why Deschamps decided to leave some individuals out when he made his final choice. And put a few of those on the subs bench, and which led to this very funny explosion by Rabiot, who was so incensed of being left out of the 23s, who decided basically he's retired from French national football at the age of 23.
Best years behind him.
Absolutely. And so I think, yes, most of these people will be put in the category of good people to live with, easy people to live with. Not all of them. I mean, I'm not going to name names, but there are three or four who are a bit more difficult and could be a bit of a problem. But otherwise, it's nothing like the tinderbox that was the team in 2010 or 2002, for that matter.
How far will they go?
I think about quarterfinals is as far as we can reasonably go. I was talking to some betting people earlier on, and I was absolutely amazed that France was given as a fourth favorite at 7-1 or something like that, which for me makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. The group shouldn't be a problem. I say shouldn't be, but again, I remember 2002, where it was not supposed to be a problem. I remember South Africa 2010, which was supposed not to be a problem. So if you discard the Australians, which I'm going to do,
okay,
I'm terribly sorry. My apologies to the future Mrs. Rushton.
No offense will be taken, I promise.
Do you think Denmark? Yeah, on that day, why not? And Peru are very much the unknown quality and quantity. I've probably watched more of Peru than most of my colleagues because I made a point of staying up late at night to watch the South American qualifiers. And I think they're far better than people are giving credit for.
On to Peru then. Here's Tim Vickery again.
They're a team who have picked up confidence in an extraordinary way. And it reminds me just a little bit. Yeah, it reminds me of Ireland in 88 in the sense that it's a team that suddenly acquired confidence. Now, Ireland were kind of free qualifiers for Euro 88, were really on the end of a beating from England in the first game, but managed to win 1-0. And then suddenly they picked up so much confidence that over the next few years, no one ever took them to town again. And Peru, they went between 2004 and late 2016. They didn't win a single away World Cup qualifier, and they didn't really draw any either. It was something like no wins, two draws and 26 defeats, with I think 14 goals scored and 70 conceded. So that they were a team that was always ready to collapse. And suddenly now, over the last 2 years, they have found confidence, and they're a different proposition. They go to the World Cup, or at least to their last warm-up game against Sweden, with the longest unbeaten run in the history of the Peruvian national team. It's now 14 games, and that includes three consecutive wins against European opposition. They beat, in March, they beat Croatia and Iceland, and they've just beaten Scotland. Now, they hadn't beaten a European team since 1999, and a real proper European team at anything like full strength since they were warming up for the 1982 World Cup. So these are very, very significant results. The coach, Ricardo Gareca, who is very reminiscent, I think. You look at him and you see a kind of fading 1970s rock guitarist. He has done a wonderful job because he's brought calm to an atmosphere that was prone to hysteria and prone to self-hatred. And he identified a promising, mainly young group of players, and he stuck with them through the bad results until they've got good results and until they've picked up form and confidence. Now, they've got the added boost that their captain, their centre forward, their all-time top scorer, Paulo Guerrero, has now been cleared to play the World Cup after this very, very harsh drug ban. It's almost hard to see now, because they've been doing so well without him, how they're going to shoehorn him into the side, although he was back with a bang on Sunday with a couple of goals against Saudi Arabia. So at the moment, everything going well for Peru. What will be interesting for them is to see whether they can hit the ground running, because the draw hasn't been particularly kind. It's Denmark, France, Australia in that order. Now, they're not expecting to get too much from the France game. They don't want to get anything from the France game. Anything they get from that game is a bonus. So that means they mustn't lose the first game against Denmark. And that's going to be an emotional test as much as anything else. We've seen sometimes from Latin American teams in this situation, you know, the first World Cup or the first World Cup of a generation, we've seen sometimes that the thing has been a little bit too much and it's almost passed them by. And it's only in the third game, by which time it's too late, that they show their best football. With Peru, they can't afford to do that. They've got to start quickly. They will be tested in the air by Denmark, and they're not great defensively in the air. But if they can come through that test, come through it with their confidence intact, then they have high hopes of getting out of the group. Returning to the World Cup after 36 years is just huge in Peru. There are even fights breaking out in shops in Lima over a few remaining packets of Panini stickers, because, you know, with the first time that they've been there since 82, everyone wants to feel part of the event. Everyone was collecting the sticker album.
On to Denmark. They won't be bringing royalty this summer. Lord Bentner is out of the squad thanks to a groin injury he picked up playing for his club side Rosenborg. Here's Troels Henriksen from Danish newspaper Jyllands Posten.
I don't see that as a big loss for the team. Of course, he had his experience, his personality. He scored goals both at the World Cup and the Euros before, but he was a bench player. He was not going to make it into the starting lineup. But another player that's been injured and has not made it to the final squad is Andreas Bjelland from Brentford. Actually, a big story here in Denmark is that Bjelland has made a press release stating that he's not injured, and he's very surprised about not being called up to the squad, and that somebody in the Danish national team told Åge Hareide that he would be injured and not make it to the Danish opening match. That's actually a bit of a almost sensational story. Åge Hareide is he's a Norwegian manager who's won the championship in the Danish, Norwegian, and Swedish league as the only manager ever to do that. He is he took over from Morten Olsen after Olsen had been the Danish national coach for 15 years, and since then he has almost dramatically changed the way the Danish national team plays. We've gone from playing a more possession style football to more aggressive, direct, with Christian Eriksen as the centerpiece of it all. A lot has been done to make space for Eriksen, to make him able to get in the good positions where he's dangerous, both in making assists for his teammates and scoring goals himself. It's been a great success, and a lot of credit needs to be set to Åge Hareide.
Australia had an incredibly long and winding road to get to this tournament. Playoffs against Syria and Honduras. His friend of the pod, Kieran Pender.
I think there's quite a bit of apprehension. The Socceroos had the longest qualification journey of any team that's going to be in Russia, both in terms of matches and geographical distance travelled, because they had to go through both the continental playoff and then the intercontinental playoff to get to Russia. So there's a lot of apprehension that this is not a vintage Socceroos team, and they'll really struggle in a tough group against France, Denmark and Peru. However, there have been a few bright spots. The Socceroos over the weekend beat the Czech Republic 4-0, which was a strong sort of pre-World Cup result. And there's a few exciting young talents in the team. So, yeah, fingers crossed, I suppose, is the attitude in Australia.
Who are the young talents?
Well, there's one in particular, a guy called Daniel Arzani. He's 19-year-old, Iranian-born forward, who's played really well in the domestic Australian A-League for Melbourne City this year. He was capped. He got his first cap in the win over the Czech Republic. He was a bit of a bolter for the squad. A lot of people didn't think he'd be picked, given his inexperience, but he's made it in there, and he could come off the bench and cause some sort of creative impact.
Mm-hmm. Group D, one of the candidates for the group of death, Argentina, Iceland, Croatia and Nigeria. Lionel Messi takes Argentina into battle in Russia, looking to cement his status as maybe, possibly, the GOAT. Here's Marcela Mora y Araujo.
So, interestingly, the president of Argentina, Mauricio Macri, who was indeed the president of Boca Juniors a few years ago and is a football man, went to bid the players farewell. And the president gave a speech, which was, of course, televised, to the players saying, please don't believe this nonsense that unless you come back with a cup, you're losers. And in fact, it's a phrase that Sampaoli has used a lot. The press and the country, the nation, have managed to make a team of men who did incredibly well and lost one game feel like losers. I don't know, if you talk to people individually, of course everyone thinks it's great to get to the final, to play good football. Nobody's expecting, the cup or nothing. But I think there's a kind of collective, not individual fans, but the whole nation somehow, and the media, of course, there's enormous pressure to actually win it. And I think for Messi, especially, not for him personally, but the expectation that Messi should win it, that it's his last chance, and that somehow if he doesn't win it, then he's a lesser man or something, is enormous. It's enormous. It's almost too much. So there's actually a whole narrative of people going, well, stop with this pressure. Of course, it would be fantastic if they do really well. In fact, there's kind of headlines of incredible long reads and, really interesting opinions saying, I love you, Messi, with no cups, no trophies. I want you just the way you are, kind of thing.
You may remember that Iceland knocked out England in Euro 2016. They've made it to their second major tournament in a row and their second ever. Friend of the pod, footbalty.net editor Maggie Mar Einarsson.
We went to Euros 2 years ago and now we're going to the World Cup. So it's a dream come true for a second time.
Does anyone in Iceland think you can do as well here as you did at the Euros?
People in Iceland are always optimistic and I think the coaches have said, we have to get out of the group. That's the first task. And if we do that, who knows? And I'm on the same page. I think if we get out of the group, anything can happen, like we showed at the Euros. You remember the game against England, maybe?
In England, you have to blank. No, to be honest, you can't blank it from your mind. It was a very strange day where we just completely forgot how to play football. But this isn't about England. You guys.
I think you can do well, and as I said, it'll be very tough because you've got a very tough group, probably one of the best group at the tournament. But if you manage to go through, who knows what will happen?
Gylfi Sigurdsson's knee. How much has been written and spoken about in Iceland about that part of that player's body?
It's probably the most famous knee in Iceland history. We have been sweating over his fitness since he came out injured against Brighton in March, but he started training this week with the team, and I'm optimistic he will play at the World Cup. There are more concerns about the captain, Aron Gunnarsson, who plays for Cardiff. Mm-hmm. He got injured last month, and he's touching goal for the first game, but he says he will be fit, but he will probably not play any friendlies before the tournament, so he will be lack of match fitness, but he's a warrior, and people in Iceland are not worried. Even though he will not play before the tournament, if he is fit for the first game against Argentina, he'll be fine.
Is there anyone else we should look out for who's perhaps come into the reckoning since the Euros?
Obviously, we got Johan Guðmundsson, who played very well for Burnley this season. He's been a rising star for the national team in the qualification and scored some vital goals and played very well. And I think he's a player you should look out for. He's a very, very good crosser, and he got a good shooting ability, and he could maybe pop up with a goal at the World Cup.
Maggie, thanks for your time and good luck.
Yeah, thank you very much.
On to Croatia, we spoke to journalist Alex Holliger to discuss his country's chances. He wasn't massively enthusiastic.
They've had really big problems against Iceland before. It's not the kind of team that suits them. Argentina is obviously always Argentina, despite them not playing well recently. And I think that would be really tough. And Nigeria, they have a really an interesting team, and also I don't think their style suits Croatia very much. So this is the first game, and if they don't win that, they will be really in trouble, I think.
Which of the players is there most pressure on to deliver? Everything comes through Luka Modric, presumably.
Yes, everything revolves around Luka Modric in Croatia, even more so than Real Madrid or whatever. He's absolutely key. And now the big debate is because manager Dalic moved him to number 10 position. This is something that he hasn't played in years since his beginnings. And now when he plays closer to the goal, he obviously doesn't have the space or the time that he used to have when he played deeper, organizing play from, you know, as deep as his own box. And this is, you know, a lot of people feel this is not the best way to utilize his talents. But we'll see. Now Rakitic, in turn, has to play deeper. And they also need someone who offers a little bit more protection defensive. That's supposed to be Milan Badej. But, you know, we'll see. I personally also don't believe this is the ideal position for Modric, and it will be pressure on him to deliver.
Finally, in Group D, Nigeria. Big debate in the office. Producer Jonathan saying this is the best kit of the tournament. I'm going Peru. But more importantly, we spoke to Nigerian Guardian journalist Solomon Fowowe on one of the worst telephone lines in the entire world.
Okay, star players at the moment, we're looking at Victor Moses. A whole lot of people would want to disagree with that, saying that he plays as a wing back at Chelsea, but at Nigeria is an entirely different player. We know that Victor Moses in his young days, when he was at Crystal Palace, was this very, very flamboyant winger. With a whole lot of tricks and quite direct too. So that's the Victor Moses we get to see in Nigeria, not the one that Antonio Conte re-engineered or re-educated into a wing back. So Victor Moses, one of the key players for Nigeria, and also Mikel. Mikel is quite an influential figure in the back room and also on the field of play. You know, most times when he's not available, the midfield tends to crumble. But when he's available, he always offers direction, calm, and dictates the tempo of the game. And it also helps that he's one of the best passers of the ball in the team. So he's one of the key players in the team. Also, that Alex Iwobi, we saw what he did against England. He was the one who, I think, courageous enough to hold on to the ball for quite a while and looking to create from the middle of the pack. So I think he's one of the important players for the Super Eagles to bring in his dynamism and also his creativity into that side. So those are the three really, really important players that you can call the key players for the Super Eagles.
So that's your preview for groups A, B, C and D. We'll be back tomorrow with groups E, F and H. Then next week, a big preview of Group G because England are in it and we're going to win the World Cup and everything. Don't forget to pick up your copy of The Guardian on Saturday for your 100-page World Cup guide and The Observer for your World Cup wall chart. I love a wall chart. The Guardian. Bing, bing, bing.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.